This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Straight from the source tonight, a CNN exclusive that is making headlines around the world. President Biden issuing a warning to Prime Minister Netanyahu. If Israel invades Rafah, the U.S. will stop sending bombs. A demand my source tonight has been making. Senator Bernie Sanders will join me live. And inside the most explosive and explicit testimony yet in the Trump hush money trial, trust me, I was there. How his attorneys are now prepping for when Stormy Daniels will retake the witness stand tomorrow. We've got an insider who is deeply sourced in Trump world. And Marjorie Taylor Greene's temper tantrum, as it is being called by her irate fellow Republicans on Capitol Hill, saying that her dramatic move late today to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson is the wrong one. Instead, now they are uniting against her. One of her most vocal Republican critics is here live. I'm Caitlin Collins, and this is The Source. Despite the constant complaints that we have heard about how his ongoing criminal trial is keeping him off the campaign trail, Donald Trump spent his day today off from court at his Mar-a-Lago club in South Florida, not on the campaign trail. But then again, after what we all heard in that courtroom yesterday, maybe it's not just the former president who needed a breather. Meanwhile, on the campaign trail today in that key battleground state of Wisconsin, President Biden is trying to beat back the issues that are vexing his campaign before November. In an exclusive interview here on CNN, Aaron Burnett asked President Biden if he's worried that he's running out of time to improve his standing with voters when it comes to the economy. Biden says that corporate greed is to blame for some of the pain that Americans are feeling. But on the whole, he argues, he's already made huge progress.
The polling data has been wrong all along. We have the strongest economy in the world. Let me say it again, in the world. No president's had the run we've had in terms of creating jobs and bringing down inflation. It was 9% when I came to office. 9%. But look, people have a right to be concerned.
President Biden also said that he thinks there's no chance his presumptive challenger, Donald Trump, will accept the results of the election. He probably will if he wins, but we'll talk more about that in a moment. We've got all of our political experts standing by. But Biden also said in this interview, for the first time, that he would stop the shipments of American weapons to Israel if Israel conducts an invasion into Rafah.
If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the Middle East recently. But it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used that have been used.
Artillery shells as well.
Yeah, artillery shells. I've made it clear to Bibi and the War Cabinet, they're not going to get our support if, in fact, they go in these population centers. We're not walking away from Israel's security. We're walking away from Israel's ability to wage war in those areas.
So it's not over your red line yet.
Not yet, but it's. We've held up the weapons. We've held up the one shipment.
Biden also acknowledged for the first time that U.S. bombs have been used by Israel to kill civilians in Gaza. That withholding that he mentioned there is that new shipment of 2,000-pound bombs that the U.S. worried could have been used in Rafah that they put on hold last week. My exclusive source on this tonight is the senior senator from Vermont, a vocal critic of both how Israel is fighting the war and American policy there in Gaza. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders. And Senator Sanders, great to have you back here on The Source. You just heard President Biden saying there, if Israel invades Rafah, he won't supply the offensive weapons to carry out that attack. Is that a strong enough response from the U.S. in your view?
Well, I think it's a good step forward. I think we've got to do even more. The bottom line is, Caitlin, is what Netanyahu has done in Gaza is unconscionable. I mean, we're talking about 35,000 Palestinians killed, 77,000 wounded, 70% of whom are women and children, over 5% of the population killed or wounded. We're talking about the destruction of 60% of the housing. Every university in Gaza has been bombed. There is virtually no clean water. Raw sewage is running all over the streets. And right now, according to humanitarian organizations, we're looking at the possibility of massive famine and starvation, hundreds of thousands of kids starving to death. In my view, Netanyahu should not have gotten a nickel so long as he continued this incredibly destructive war. I'm glad to see that the president is beginning to move in that direction.
Yeah, you're saying beginning in a good step. It doesn't sound like it goes far enough for you.
It doesn't, but I hope it continues. I hope the president understands what we all understand. Israel had a right to defend itself against the horrific Hamas attack, killing 1,200 people. But you don't have the right to go to war against the entire Palestinian people and bring about unprecedented damage and destruction and death. And America should not be complicit in what is going on there right now.
You know, even with this warning, obviously the Israeli military already has enough weapons supplied by the U.S. and by other nations to carry out the invasion of Rafah if it so chooses to do so. So, I mean, is it a warning that, in your view, comes too late, maybe?
Well, it should have come a lot earlier. But look, the truth is we are sitting on billions of dollars of military support for Israel, which the president could deny them tomorrow. Netanyahu understands that we have enormous leverage, and the time is long overdue for us to utilize that leverage. I voted against giving Netanyahu another $10 billion for offensive weapons. I hope we can move in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, you're standing in the halls of Capitol Hill that just approved and passed a lot more aid to Israel. But, you know, some other people who view this differently than you do may look at it and say, well, President Biden has also said Israel should do what it takes to defeat Hamas. And the IDF says that there are Hamas battalions in Rafah, that Yahya Sinwar, a key leader of Hamas, is there. Hostages are there. So I think some people may hear this and say, well, what should Israel do?
Look, it is a difficult issue. Hamas is a very difficult enemy to fight. They are a terrorist group. They use civilian shields. It is true. But look, what America cannot and must not be part of is literally the destruction of all of Gaza. I mean, the infrastructure, education, the healthcare system decimated, and so many women and children who are killed. So yes, you've got to go after Hamas, but no, you cannot continue your effort literally almost to destroy the entire people in that region.
The last time that you and I spoke, you declined to say whether you believed Israel was committing a genocide. Are you prepared to do so now?
Look, that is a media question that is asked all the time, and it generates.
But people care about that question.
No. Look, no. What people care about is stopping Netanyahu from the massive destruction that he is bringing forth in Gaza right now. As you know, the International Court of Justice is looking at that issue. What constitutes genocide? Is it the killing of 6 million Jews in World War II? Is it 2 million Cambodians being killed by Pol Pot? Is it what happened in Rwanda? You know, I'll let the International Court of Justice determine that. What I will tell you, though, what is going on now is horrific. It is unacceptable. And we have got to use all of our leverage to stop it.
Okay, so you're not prepared to call it a genocide yet. You have been obviously really outspoken on this. And one thing that you told Christian Amanpour is that you believe that this could be President Biden's Vietnam. You know, Senator, obviously you lived through the draft. 58,000 Americans died. And I do wonder, but what do you mean in the comparison
between
those two?
That's the wrong Caitlin, that's the wrong point to be made. Of course, this is not Vietnam. Of course, tens of thousands of American soldiers are not dying in this war.
Right.
The point was a political point, and that is that Lyndon Johnson, in many ways, was a very, very good president. Brought forth some major pieces of legislation that helped working people, that helped low-income people. He brought forth Medicare helping senior citizens. He chose, despite all of those accomplishments, he chose not to run for re-election in 68 because of his support for the war and the opposition, grassroots opposition to the war in Vietnam. That's the point you made. It's a political question. Obviously, this is not like the war in Vietnam in terms of American participation.
Okay, well, I'm glad you cleared that up because I had seen some responses when you initially said that. So I'm glad you cleared that up. And, you know, you are so connected with young voters, with progressive voters. You're a champion for them. Do you think that President Biden could lose the election over this?
Well, that's what I worry about. Look, I think Biden has a lot of accomplishments. And the point that I would make and have made before, Joe Biden is not running against God. He's not running against the perfect candidate. He's running against the guy named Donald Trump, the most dangerous president in the history of this country. So what I would say to young people and all Americans, if you believe in the foundations of American democracy, you cannot vote for Trump, who is undermining democracy. If you believe that women have a right to control their own bodies, you can't vote for Trump. He appointed the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade. If you believe that climate change is real and we got to save this planet for our kids and future generations, you can't vote for Donald Trump. He believes climate change is a hoax. If you think that you're concerned that we have massive income and wealth inequality, you can't support Trump because he wants to give billions of dollars in tax breaks to the 1%. So I think, Biden is not a perfect candidate. I have very strong disagreements with him over Gaza. I'm glad to see he's making some good movements forward. But the choice in this election is pretty clear.
Can I ask you a question about the campus protests that we've seen and a comment that your fellow Senator John Fetterman made about those protests? He said that the students are working against peace, that they don't know what they're protesting against. And he said it's helping Hamas from a PR perspective. What's your response to that?
No, I think that the students do know what they are protesting. And they are looking at what's going on in Gaza and the massive killing of women and children. And they are saying, you know what, our great country should not be part of that type of destruction. They understand that Netanyahu not only has a right-wing government, it is a government in which you have out-and-out racists attached to it, working with Netanyahu. So I think I'm not going to speak to every single protester, but I think the overwhelming majority know exactly what they're talking about, and they want U.S. To end U.S. complicity in that war.
Senator Bernie Sanders, always great to have you here on The Source. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Caitlin.
Up next, those halls of Capitol Hill aren't as quiet as they are right now because earlier, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene over in the House finally made good on her threat to try to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson. It failed spectacularly on the House floor. We're going to be joined by one of many in the party who voted against that tonight. Also, how Donald Trump's legal team is preparing for another stormy day in court tomorrow. New reporting ahead.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene succeeded at one thing tonight, infuriating almost everybody in her party, all because she moved to oust Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson onto the floor in a surprise move.
The reality of this is this is like the congressional version of a temper tantrum.
Most of us, by the time we turn 12 years old, figure out that tantrums don't actually work. And apparently not everybody in Congress has got the memo. She is engaged in a failing act of political theater.
Marjorie wants to, you know, sow chaos and division within the Republican Party.
Moscow Marjorie has clearly gone off the deep end, maybe the result of a space laser.
The attempt to remove the House Speaker lasted about half an hour earlier today, as a majority of Democrats in the House helped shut it down and keep him in his job. One of the 196 Republicans who wanted nothing to do with that motion is here joining me now, South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson. And Congressman Thomas Massey, your colleague, it was the one seated right behind Marjorie Taylor Greene as she introduced this earlier today. He said earlier that he has sympathy for those of you who are lashing out at us right now, the few of you we just showed on the steps, because, quote, they're going to go home and take an ass whipping from their base because they voted wrong here tonight. What's your response to that?
Thomas is a smart guy, but he's being pretty dumb here. I mean, I've spent a lot of time at home. I go home every weekend to South Dakota. I talk to hundreds of people every weekend. They're not focused on this, Caitlin. What they want is for us to actually be big boys and big girls and get our work done. I think they're actually a little exasperated by all the D.C. power games. And so, listen, Thomas, I love you, but you are dead wrong on this.
What does it say, though, about the state of the GOP that in the House conference that you needed Democrats to help save the Republican speaker?
I get it. Everybody always wants to talk about the R's and the D's. I try not to get all caught up in that, Caitlin. I mean, if you're Speaker Mike Johnson, your job is week in and week out to go do something good for America, and you got to get 218 votes to get that done. Now, that coalition is going to look a little different in any given vote. Today, the coalition, we had good people, good Americans who crave stability, who crave real work, who came together to push back against the chaos of Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Do you believe that she should be removed from the Republican conference for what she did?
I've got a lot of my colleagues who are talking about punishment. I'm not so much into punishment. The only thing I want is a U.S. House that works, that gets our job done. I'm really open to some rule changes that would help us do that. Admittedly, some people will look at those rule changes and assume that the motivation is about punishment. It is not for me. I just know we got real stuff to tackle, and these kinds of games are not helpful.
Congressman Dusty Johnson, I have a feeling we might see them again in the future. Thank you for joining with us tonight in this breaking news.
Thank you.
And our political sources here tonight on all of this, former Trump campaign advisor Jason Osborne, CNN political commentator and author of The Moment, Bakari Sellers, as well as former New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. I mean, Jason, your party, tell us.
I don't really know what her point was, other than I feel like a number of these members, like Marjorie Taylor and Matt Gaetz, is that they're listening to, or they think that their constituents are on Twitter. And they're not listening to what the folks back home in their district actually have to say about this. And to Dustin's point, I guarantee you that there is probably a scintilla of amount of pressure back home for any of these members with regard to Mike Johnson, if they even know his name. This is all an effort by Marjorie Taylor. She got caught in a box and realized that there was the only way out for her was to actually go ahead and pull the trigger on this. She knew she was going to lose, and now she's going to try and fundraise off of it. This idea that you're going to kick her out of the conference, I don't even know what that means, because she's still a Republican and she's still going to vote Republican, but maybe she's not on a committee and she survived, you know, several months without being on a committee last Congress.
I mean, what Donald Trump weighed in, though, on this. I mean, I don't think this threat hasn't gone away, because he didn't explicitly condemn it. One, weighed in after the vote had already happened, urging them to kill it. But two, he said, you know, maybe we'll need to use this at another time, but saying basically that time is not now.
For Democrats, and I actually agree, but for Democrats, what we realize is that Republicans can't govern. Every time Republicans get in leadership, what we recognize quickly is that they have a fundamental inability to govern. You know, we did repeal and replace, right? Remember that whole fiasco where they were going to repeal and replace Obamacare. They went through this whole episode, they got elected on it, and then all of a sudden, they weren't able to do that. You had a speaker just recently, Kevin McCarthy. Now you have Mike Johnson. People realize the job is too big for him. No one's really paying attention to the palace intrigue, but what they are realizing is that Republicans simply can't govern. And so what this means, I do believe, and I'll bet you a steak dinner on this, maybe a little bit of tequila, but definitely a steak dinner, is that Hakeem Jeffries is going to be the next Speaker of the House.
Well, so there is reporting, Manu had said that a progressive told him that Hakeem Jeffries approached and basically said, there's one time that we'll save Mike Johnson's speakership. Essentially, it's not going to happen many times. I don't think anyone thought they'd see the day where a Democrat would save a House Speaker in this kind of House. But how do Democrats handle this? Is Mike Johnson better than an alternative, or would it end up where, you know, Hakeem Jeffries is the Speaker?
I give Hakeem Jeffries a lot of credit. He cut a deal, I'm sure, that works for the Democrats. And look, the bigger statement here the American people are seeing is an incredibly ununified, dissonant, upset, angry Republican Party. I mean, we have a Republican Party that actually resembles what the Democratic Party so often used to look like. This is almost like a total flip, Caitlin. It's kind of amazing. I've never seen the Democratic Party this unified in my entire life. And it's been decades since Republicans were this dysfunctional. I mean, there's primaries everywhere now, and they're turning on their own speakers all the time. And the idea, look at even in Indiana the other night, you have most of 20% of Republican voters turning against their own nominee. Something's wrong in the Republican Party, and every time they have one of these dysfunctional fights, it communicates to the American people. They're the party of dysfunction. Actually, today, Democrats are the party of unity and stability. Never thought I'd be able to say it, but
well,
it's true.
You're talking about that zombie vote for Nikki Haley. We're still seeing it in Pennsylvania. We saw it in Indiana. It's remarkable. She's not even in this race, and people are still voting for her. But speaking of what that race is going to look like, in this interview with Aaron Burnett earlier, President Biden weighed in on this idea of former President Trump not accepting the results of the election. This is what he said.
The guy is not a Democrat with a small D. I mean, he is the idea, look, you can't only love your country when you win, number one. How many court cases do they have? Supreme Court cases. They all said this is totally legitimate election. This is Trump. I mean, it's saying whether he may not accept the outcome of the election. I promise you he won't.
I mean, he probably will if he wins. I mean, I think Donald Trump.
Right. I mean, I admit that is a problem.
No. Say I agree with Joe Biden. Say it.
I'm not going to say I agree with Joe Biden because I was having a hard time following
what he said. Yet.
I will say that I think for any election, I think it's disappointing to see folks like Tim Scott and others that are not saying that they will accept the results of the election. You can say the election should be fair and free, right? And you can demand that throughout the process. But starting now to cast a dispersion on what the election may end up being, I think is a troubling sign, and we're going to continue to hear it throughout the rest of this.
I mean, that Tim Scott moment was remarkable. He would not say whether or not he would accept it. South Carolina, what did you make of it?
I really want to toss this to somebody else. I know Tim Scott very well.
We got New York over here.
Yeah, I know New York and over there. I know Tim Scott. I love Tim Scott. I've said this many times before. I would give Tim Scott a kidney today if he asked me for it. I would never vote for him. The person that we're seeing today, though, is someone who is really fighting very, very valiantly to be vice president of the United States, and he'll probably land it somewhere around Secretary of HUD if he's lucky. And I think Donald Trump has this unique ability to transform grown men into something that we're not used to seeing them be. And that's going to be a story that's told 20 years from now, how people like Tim Scott or Lindsey Graham or other people who we thought had some fortitude just crumbled in his hands.
I agree with that. I think the psychological reality of Trump is something that's still been underexamined. We look back into history. Why did certain leaders sort of capture their nation's psyche in ways that often were not productive? Obviously, you think of, to use a very different analogy, I'm not going to compare directly, but you think of your Mussolinis and your Hitlers in one level.
You can't just throw that out there, Mr. Mayor.
No, I'm saying you can't make a direct comparison, but how did nations fall under the sway? Equally, you think of other leaders. Charles de Gaulle at one point in France had, you know, France enraptured with him, or Churchill in the best moments in Britain. So I'm trying to make a broader point. Certain leaders have a psychological ability to get under the skin of their people. But the difference here, and I think it's a very notable difference, is that Trump has a kind of a narcissism that is so obviously destructive to everything around it. How many people, I mean, it's not just Michael Cohen, how many people from his world have left in disgust, in anger, feeling betrayed? How many people did he stiff when he was in business and never paid? This is a pattern that I think makes him unique. And I think this time the trick's not working the same way. Him being in the courtroom every day, I mean, what I thought was amazing today with Aaron's interview, Joe Biden's in Wisconsin. Now, our candidates some years ago didn't remember to go to the battleground states enough, but Joe Biden has been out in Wisconsin and Michigan and these states in Pennsylvania incessantly. Where's Donald Trump? In a courtroom.
We'll make sure Hillary Clinton sees that you said that. Jason Osborne, Bukari Sellers, Bill de Blasio, happy birthday. Thank you for joining us here.
Happy birthday. Happy 40th.
Where better to be on your birthday than The Source? All right, and speaking of that testimony in the courthouse, we're just hours away from the return of Stormy Daniels to the witness stand at that hush money trial. Trump was cursing audibly in the court yesterday during her testimony. We're going to be joined by my source, who is also inside that courtroom next. The adult film star Stormy Daniels left little to the imagination during her hours-long testimony yesterday detailing her alleged sexual encounter with Donald Trump, including how she swatted him with a rolled-up magazine that it has face on it in a Lake Tahoe hotel room as they first met, even reenacting how she says that Trump posed on the bed for her as she exited from the bathroom. Details that were so explicit that the judge, Juan Merchan, had to cut her off multiple times and remind the prosecution to keep her answering the questions they had asked her. It wasn't just what she said, but also how she said it. I was in the courtroom, and she also almost seemed to be taunting Donald Trump. He was seething away at the defense table, forced to listen to every word. My source tonight was also inside that courtroom while all of this went down and has been there every day. New York Times senior political correspondent and CNN political analyst Maggie Haberman. And I mean, it's been over 24 hours, but I kind of feel like I'm still processing what we witnessed in there.
Yeah, what I do for a living requires words, and I was still having trouble to come up with the words to describe what I saw. It is actually something of a travesty, at least just for the public, that there are no cameras allowed in courtrooms in New York for this reason. But it was incredibly intense. And as you said, a lot of the detail was excruciating. Now, prosecutors made the argument that they needed to get into some of this detail to show what she would have said had she told her story in 2016, and therefore what Trump was worried about coming out. That's their argument. The judge had put pretty constrained parameters on what that was supposed to be. And as you said, her testimony blew past that over and over and over. Todd Blanche, Trump's lead defense lawyer, objected several times. Many of those objections were sustained. That's all stuff the jury got to see. And the judge was clearly not pleased, as we got to see out of the jury's presence. But it was a lot. I mean, it was talk about a condom. It was talk about the sexual position.
I know, but it's hard to stop because you also want people to know what we heard and what we saw. And that's, I think, the difficulty is, like, we're just relaying what's now in the court record. And you know, you reported before all this started, the trial, that the hardest part you had heard from sources of what Trump was going to have to, the part of this is not, you know, necessarily the outcome, but the just process. Sitting there and listening.
Yeah, it's the process. It is everything from having to be in this really decrepit courthouse and courtroom to having to listen to that, and that was what a lot of people around Trump were very concerned about him sitting through. They weren't positive that Stormy Daniels was going to get called, but they thought there was a chance of it. And they were concerned about what level of lurid detail would be gone into. Todd Blanche's argument was this was done just to shock. The prosecutors argued otherwise. I think the defense had one of its best days yesterday because Susan Nicholas, in her cross-examination, and she's not done with cross-examination, mm-hmm. that'll resume tomorrow, she did get some dents into Stormy Daniels' story. But does it ultimately matter? I don't know, because we don't know how the jury is viewing this. And at the end of the day, Stormy Daniels still told the details of that early encounter the way she's told it before and the way she has told it in various forums. And, you know, at the end of the day, that is what underlies this case, not other specifics related to who wants to make money or whether, you know, that is going to be the defense argument, is that she is out to get money. I'm not sure that the jury will necessarily see Trump as a victim here.
Yeah, and one, the question of whether the Trump team wants to revisit those details that we heard.
Right.
You know, he's posting today, you know, he has his gag order in place, but mm-hmm. he's kind of basically going around it saying sleazebags, lowlifes, and grifters who are allowed to say anything they want while he's, you know, asking this New York appeals court to speed up the appeal mm-hmm. on his gag order. I mean,
It must be incredibly difficult for him to not be able to comment on her testimony.
I think we're seeing that. I mean, I think that we're seeing every day that he is having trouble not commenting on her or her testimony. We talked about the more graphic details, but there were other aspects of this testimony that were really striking, including Stormy Daniels getting asked about a Truth Social post where he calls her horse face. There was another moment where she, you know, points him to identify him on the stand while she's on the stand and while he's at the defense table. It was all very intense. It was riveting. This was a confrontation that has been in the making for many, many years. She actually got in, while I think the defense had some very good moments in the afternoon for what they were trying to do, she did come across well at points in the afternoon where she was defending herself. So at one point, Susan Nicholas said something to the effect of, "You stood to make a lot from this in terms of money." And she said, "It's also cost me a lot." And I think that that might resonate with jurors, because the whole case that the prosecutors are telling is that people who come into contact with Donald Trump, whether it's Stormy Daniels or Michael Cohen, end up suffering.
The moment when she stood up and identified him, it felt like every ounce of oxygen was sucked out of that room.
I mean, yes.
And it happened kind of quickly, like in the middle. She'd already been testifying for about 10 minutes when she stood up to do it.
Yes, that was certainly one of many moments that I thought felt that way. There were other moments, too, and there was a moment of sort of disbelief, and I know we've clearly both articulated some level of shock at what we were hearing yesterday. Not shock that it happened, just sort of shocking being there, hearing this said on the stand with the former president of the United States feet away. But that was one of those moments where it was, oh, she really is going ahead with this. And there was a moment early on, as before she came to the stand and the lawyers for the defense and the lawyers for the prosecution were debating with the judge about what could be allowed in. And Justice Merchan was very clear, "I'm allowing a very narrow strip here." And Susan Hoffinger, the prosecutor who was questioning Stormy Daniels, said something to the effect of, "Well, I have to be able to ask these questions. We do need to know X, Y, Z." We didn't quite know what that meant. It became very clear what that meant very early on. But there was much more to the testimony than just the bit we have talked about.
Yeah, and also speaks to the years of denials from him.
Correct.
Maggie Haberman, I know you'll be back there tomorrow. Thank you. More to come on what to expect tomorrow in court, including new reporting on what the defense plans to do when they're cross-examining Stormy Daniels. Also, how all of Trump's trials keep getting delayed, all the other ones at least.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. Join me, Philip Nguyen, a scholar of Vietnamese-American culture, and the cast and crew as we discuss the making of this historic series. Subscribe now to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and stream HBO's The Sympathizer starting April 14th exclusively on Max.
Gird your loins, as they say, because when Stormy Daniels gets back on that witness stand tomorrow morning, it promises to be yet another day of dramatic testimony. As we know, Trump's defense team is going to try to undermine her again as they cross-examine her as part of this testimony. As we just mentioned with Ab Maggie, the lurid details that jurors heard on Tuesday may have been a bit much, according to the judge at least. Some of it was better left unsaid. But that sexual encounter, which Trump has repeatedly denied ever happened, is at the very heart of why a hush money payment was made in the first place. For more on what we could see tomorrow, I'm joined tonight by David Kelly, a former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. I mean, what do you think the defense does when she gets on the stand tomorrow? Is it a quick cross-examination as they wrap up, or they drag it out?
I think they spend some more time with her. Susan Nicholas, I mean, there's a reason why Susan's doing it and not Todd. Mm-hmm. And they're looking to not offend people, but they're trying to make her look really bad. I think the challenge is that her appeal is the fact that she's not appealing. From a prosecutor's perspective, I mean, that's what you're trying to paint here. You're not trying to make this look like some lovely person. She's not. And they don't hide from that. So I'm not quite sure what more the defense can accomplish here. But I think the temptation to drag it out a little bit more is probably going to be a little overwhelming, and you'll see a little bit more cross-examination. But remember, the prosecution gets to do some redirect examination and clean some things up.
And so they'll get that chance. You know, Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen were the last two big blockbuster witnesses. How quickly do they move to put him on the stand, or does this make them kind of tamp down that? What does that look like?
Well, look, I don't think this prosecution team has not dragged things out. They've done things very quickly. The judge has controlled the courtroom very well, so this has moved really apace. I don't know that there's much more to do here. They'll do some more document stuff, I think, after Ms. Daniels finishes her testimony. But then it's time for Cohen. And I think from a prosecutor's standpoint, there's a temptation to think, geez, do we really need, given everything the way it's come in, do we need Cohen? The problem is that they've set this thing up. They're going to have to put Cohen on. But I'm saying this as a temptation to think maybe we don't need him. They're going to put him on. And I think that will be, you know, they may put another witness on after Cohen just to kind of
to turn the temperature down.
But it's hard to say.
If we thought Stormy Daniels was the testimony was, you know, insane to just witness and intense, I mean, Michael Cohen would be even more so. But overall, you know, as we've been watching Trump's trial and thinking about the fact that there are no cameras in that courtroom, you know, I was thinking about the other cases that he's facing. Because in the last few days, as we've been covering minute by minute of the New York trial, Judge Eileen Cannon in Florida has indefinitely delayed his classified documents case. Georgia, the appeals court there, said they would hear Trump's request to try to get the district attorney, Fani Willis, disqualified. I mean, who knows when the Supreme Court's going to make their decision on immunity. Every other of these major cases all delayed now.
Yeah, but, you know, look, the Fani Willis case, the Georgia case, I didn't see that as likely to get going anytime soon in any event. There's a lot of defendants, a lot of things to accomplish. It's not moving really apace. So I don't think that that's a big deal. The case in Florida, the federal case with the classified documents, I don't get that. I think they've made that case too complicated. The question is whether or not the items are classified, the documents. Some of the documents, whether or not it relates to defense material. But overall, it doesn't really matter what the substance of the documents are. Were they classified or were they not classified?
Also, there's easy motions that the judge is not
even
moving on.
Easy stuff that she's just not moving on. Then the question lots of folks raise, is this because of some sort of political bent of the judge or is it incompetence? Is it a fear to try to tackle these issues because she's not confident in her ability to do it? We've heard reports about her, you know, in her chambers. She doesn't really have the support she needs. So there could be a whole host of factors here. But the bottom line is she is not moving things the way any judge would try to move. Even as you point out, there's some very simple motions that could get decided here. So it really, the thing that concerns me most that it undermines the credibility and it doesn't instill confidence in the judicial system.
It's remarkable. David Kelly, we'll see what that cross-examination looks like tomorrow. Thank you for that. Up next, I mean, you got to just kind of hear this one to believe it, because apparently the dead worm that once ate part of RFK Jr.'s brain. I'm not kidding here. This is a health issue flagged by the presidential candidate himself. More next. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says a worm got into his brain, ate a portion of it, and then died, revealing this bizarre health episode, if we are calling it that, according to the New York Times, during a 2012 deposition for a divorce proceeding. The presidential candidate described in that deposition what doctors told him in 2010 when he sought treatment for severe memory loss and mental fogginess. Kennedy told the Times that the parasite didn't require treatment and that he has recovered with no after effects. My source on this tonight, CNN senior political data reporter, Harry Enten. Harry, I mean...
yeah.
I read this. It's like one of those things that you read it and you click on it and then you read it again and you're like, did I read that?
It truly is just another element to the bizarre political world that we've seemed to been a part of for the past a little less than a decade. And RFK Jr. coming onto the scene and you're going, okay, we know that both parties have nominated candidates who a lot of the American public don't like, who have net negative favorability ratings, and you end up nominating, and then the third party candidate who could potentially be somebody is RFK Jr., who obviously has a whole bunch of things going on. And this just adds to it, Caitlin. But the thing I'll point out is, he's actually doing pretty gosh darn good in the polls, right? I mean, look what he's polling nationally. He's pulling in on average 13% of the vote. That's the best for a third party candidate at this point in the cycle since Ross Perot in 1996. And more than that, remember the threshold to make the debates is 15%. He's right there. All he needs to do is slightly better, and he could be on the stage.
So we could actually see him on the debate stage?
Absolutely. This is a very plausible thing. I mean, look, if you look at his polls, you might have suspected, as more people have gotten to know him, that his polling might have gone down a little bit. But the fact is, it's basically holding in the low to mid-teens. So all he needs is a little bump in the cycle. Maybe Trump and Biden lose a little bit of favorable ratings, and he could be at that 15%, and he could be on the debate stage.
And I should note that his campaign said, you know, this issue with the dead worm in his brain was resolved more than 10 years ago, and he is in robust physical and mental health. I mean, polling the best since Ross Perot, I think it would surprise some people who maybe dismiss his candidacy and don't take it seriously.
I think that's definitely the case. But the fact is, especially with Trump and Biden not polling particularly well, I don't think it's too much of a surprise that a third party candidate is polling as well as he's doing at this point.
The other news story that I'm obsessed with this week, the other political story, is what is happening to South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. I mean, I have never seen and witnessed a soft book launch that, you know, vice presidential hopefuls always do go as poorly as hers. And now she's canceling interviews with CNN. She's canceling interviews with Fox News. I mean, it's kind of like a bipartisan issue. You're seeing Republicans come out and criticize her.
What the heck is she doing? Thank God she's starting to cancel these interviews because they were gosh darn awful. She kept digging herself more of a hole. Who goes after dogs in America? They have a favorable rating of 88%. People either like them a lot or like them a little. And look at that, like them a lot, 74%. You see my face on the stage there on that photo of my childhood dog, Cody. I love dogs. Cody, who is adorable, a little less absent. You're going after dogs. You're going after people's hearts and souls. And thank God she decided to cancel her press stuff because she was just doing awful at it.
Well, it wasn't just that. It was also the Kim Jong-un completely made-up story.
It's a complete disaster.
Harry Enten, not a complete disaster.
Thank you
for being here. Up next, a CNN special that you may remember, this shocking murder that happened. It was the Olympic superstar, Oscar Pistorius, who went to prison for years after he was convicted of killing his fashion model girlfriend. A preview of this Sunday's new installment of the CNN original series, How It Really Happened. It started off as a charming love affair between a world-famous athlete and a fashion model, and it ended with a 4 hollow point bullets through their bathroom door. This Sunday's episode of How It Really Happened investigates whether or not it was a terrible accident or a callous murder.
Early in the morning of February the 14th, the neighbors woke up to ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. The first people who arrived found a really gruesome scene. They saw a man carrying a woman down the stairs, and he was hysterical. He laid her body at the bottom of the stairs on the tiles.
He was bathed in blood and shrieking and howling and crying.
I just sat there with her and I waited for the ambulance to arrive. I felt hopeless. I wanted to take her to the hospital. I was trying to stop the bleeding.
Oscar Pistorius tried to save her. Others there tried to save her, but there was nothing that they could do for her.
Be sure to watch How It Really Happened, Oscar Pistorius, The Blade Runner, this Sunday at 9 o'clock here on CNN. Thank you all so much for joining us. CNN Newsnight with Abby Phillips starts right now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832. And tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.